In the summer of 1940, the people of Jersey, a quiet British island nestled in the English Channel, woke to a grim new reality. The Union Jack was lowered. A red, white, and black flag now flew in its place. Jersey was occupied. But this wasn't France or Poland or even mainland Britain. This was something different. An occupation measured not just in tanks or patrols, but in silence, tension, and slow erosion. Welcome to History Unpacked. If you enjoy the content, consider subscribing. We upload every week and we welcome any feedback. This is the story of 5 years of Nazi rule on British soil, of life resistance, compliance, and quiet survival. When the German army swept across Western Europe in 1940, Britain braced for invasion. But some territories were simply abandoned, among them the Channel Islands. Strategically close to France, but small and exposed, the British government made a quiet decision. It would not defend them. In June 1940, Jersey and its neighbouring islands were demilitarised. British forces left. Official communications were vague, and many islanders didn't know if they were staying under British protection or not. Some evacuated, most didn't. They stayed in their homes, tended their gardens, ran their shops, until the bombers came. On 28 June, German aircraft bombed Jersey's harbour, mistaking trucks for military vehicles. 10 civilians died. 2 days later, German troops arrived. There was no resistance, no shots fired. The Germans simply landed, walked ashore, and took control. Occupation came swiftly and efficiently. German officers moved into government buildings. Orders were printed in German and English. Curfews were imposed. Radios were confiscated. The currency changed. And so did the language. Street signs, government forms, even menus started to reflect the occupiers' tongue. But unlike in mainland Europe, the Germans here didn't arrive as conquerors so much as bureaucrats. The Channel Islands were meant to be a model occupation, a showcase of German order on British soil. No death camps, no mass deportations, no overt brutality, at least not at first. Instead, the Germans relied heavily on the cooperation of local authorities. Jersey's government remained in place on paper. In practice, it was subordinate. The bailiff, Alexander Kutansch, walked a careful line, keeping order, protecting civilians, but carrying out German directives. To some, he was a pragmatist, to others, a collaborator. For the average islander, daily life became a quiet negotiation. Rations grew tighter, electricity and gas were unreliable, food shortages worsened as the war dragged on. The island was effectively cut off from the mainland. German troops, eventually numbering over 10,000, were everywhere. They built bunkers, gun emplacements, and concrete fortifications that remain to this day. They were part of Hitler's so-called Atlantic Wall, designed to repel any Allied landing. Social contact between locals and German soldiers was discouraged, but not forbidden. Some relationships did form, others were transactional. Children born of German fathers and Jersey mothers would become a delicate topic after the war. More controversial still was the use of forced labour. Eastern European prisoners, often from Russia, Ukraine and Poland, were brought to the island to work on fortifications. They lived in grim conditions, sometimes beaten, sometimes starved. Their presence was a quiet reminder that the war's darker realities were never far away. Islanders were forbidden to shelter or feed them, but some did. A few helped them escape, and it was dangerous work. Open resistance was rare. There were no guns, no sabotage teams, and no pitched battles. But resistance took other forms. A local man, Frank Faller, secretly printed and distributed news from the BBC. Others listened illegally to banned radio broadcasts and passed the information by word of mouth. A woman named Louisa Gould sheltered a Russian escapee for nearly 2 years before she was caught. She was sent to Ravensbrück concentration camp and did not return. A total of over 300 islanders were deported to German prisons or camps for acts of defiance, some for writing graffiti, others for keeping radios, and some simply for speaking out. Their sentences were harsh, and many died in captivity. But perhaps the most enduring resistance was cultural. Islanders found ways to assert their identity, celebrating Liberation Day in secret, teaching English history quietly to their children, singing band hymns. These were small acts, but they were defiant. As the war dragged on, so did the occupation, and with it came suspicion, weariness, and slow emotional erosion. Islanders began to turn inward. Trust became a luxury. Who was working with the Germans? Who was reporting on neighbours? Who was simply trying to survive? There were accusations, some true and some born of fear. After the war, some residents would be branded collaborators. Others were quietly shunned. But in truth, most people had lived in the grey. Neither heroes nor traitors, but humans caught in an unnatural situation. In 1942, things took a darker turn. The Germans, fearing dissent, ordered the deportation of thousands of non-native British citizens, people who had been born on the mainland but made Jersey their home. Over 1,000 men, women and children were forcibly removed and sent to internment camps in Germany. They were kept until the end of the war. The deportation shocked the island and deepened the sense of helplessness. If you could be taken for simply being born in the wrong place, who was safe? By 1944, after the Allied landings in Normandy, the Channel Islands were cut off completely. Supplies dwindled to nothing. Germany refused to evacuate the garrisons, even though they were strategically useless. Hitler had decided the islands were to be held at all costs. And so began what many islanders remember as the worst part of the occupation. Not for violence, but for hunger. Bread disappeared, people ate seaweed, boiled grass and roots, livestock vanished. In the winter of 1944-45, malnutrition became widespread. Deaths from starvation began to climb. It was only with the arrival of the Red Cross ship Vega in December 1944 that famine was averted. The ship brought food, medical supplies and news from the outside world. For many, it was the first contact with Britain in 4 years. On 8th of May 1945, Germany surrendered. For Jersey, the news came by radio from German officers who no longer had orders to follow. The islanders gathered quietly. There were no fireworks, no bands, just waiting. The next morning, British ships arrived on the horizon. The liberation of Jersey came not with gunfire, but with the footsteps of sailors climbing onto the pier. Crowds gathered, people wept, flags emerged from hiding, church bells rang. After 5 long years, the island was British again. The German garrison, over 10,000 strong, surrendered without resistance. Most were exhausted, emaciated, and ready for the war to be over. Their once pristine uniforms hung loose from their shoulders. In the years that followed, the occupation of Jersey became a complicated chapter in British history. It didn't fit neatly into narratives of glory or resistance. There were no great battles, no decisive heroes, just people enduring, adapting, and in quiet ways, resisting. Some islanders never spoke of it. Some wrote memoirs, raised monuments, and recorded oral histories. The occupation became a touchstone for debates about loyalty, courage, and compromise. The physical remnants are still there, bunkers, tunnels, concrete sea walls. The emotional ones too, though harder to see. Today, Jersey is a peaceful, prosperous place, but its wartime years remain close beneath the surface, visible in the museums, the memorials, and the memories of those who lived through it. It was the only part of the British Isles to fall under Nazi control, and for 5 long years, it existed in a liminal state, British, but not free, occupied but not quite conquered. The story of Jersey is not one of fire and fury, it's one of endurance, of silence, of what it means to live under occupation, not in theory, but in the daily lived reality of a people caught between two worlds.